In the matter of Sandra Wojtas versus Greenwood Tree Experts, can we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honor. Matthew Nunn from Einhorn Harris on behalf of the appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors. Bonnie Frost of Einhorn Harris as well.
Good morning, Justice. I'm Lauren Iannacrone from the law firm of Thomas Foley, and we're here on behalf of defendant respondents, who are Christina Wojtas, Taylor Wojtas, Connor Wojtas, and Christina Wojtas as the guardian of minor child J.T. Wojtas.
Good morning. Andrew Sales with Connell Foley for the defendant respondent.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Nunn.
Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the court. Mr. Chief Justice, may I reserve 3 minutes for a rebuttal?
Yes.
Thank you. Suicide is perhaps the most irrational of all human behavior. Yet, according to the CDC and the National Institute of Health, suicide is one of the leading causes of death around the world. And in New Jersey, suicides are nearly double the homicide rate in recent years. In this case, the suicide of Tim Wojtas left three children without their father, the appellant without her husband, and a dispute between the decedent's estate and several interested parties. Now, like many divorce cases in which alimony and child support obligations exist, the decedent and his ex-wife agreed that the decedent would maintain certain life insurance policies as security for his alimony and child support obligations. And he, in fact, maintained those policies. Unfortunately, due to the manner of death, that being suicide, a $100,000 policy intended to benefit Christina Wojtas, the decedent's ex-wife, and a $750,000 policy intended to secure child support and child-related expenses did not pay out. Now, both the trial court and appellate division concluded, citing to Tintacalis, a California appellate court decision, that the decedent's suicide standing alone amounted to a breach of the marital settlement agreement. Although not saying it directly in these terms, the appellate division decision was clearly relying on the notion that the decedent had an implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, and an implied covenant not to commit suicide to do something that would frustrate the policies. Of course, as this court has said in multiple cases, if the theory of breach is based on some implied covenant, the motivations and intentions of the purported breaching party is relevant to the overall assessment of the breach. In this case, the appellate division said that the decedent's intent had no bearing on its decision. But there's a second provision in the marital settlement agreement. The parties agreed that if either one of them failed to maintain the MSA-required life insurance, their estate would be liable for any, quote, outstanding obligations owed under the agreement. Notwithstanding that language, the appellate division held that the outstanding obligations were equal to the death benefit of the two life insurance policies, the $100,000 and the $750,000 policy. Indeed, the appellate division said to conclude otherwise would be to, quote, impermissibly rewrite the MSA. And I submit to the court that the appellate division's interpretation of the words outstanding obligations impermissibly rewrote the MSA. Your Honors, our state should not have a bright-line rule or a presumption that any time a suicide renders performance of a contractual term incapable of performance or an impossibility, that breach equals suicide. And in this case, even if the court were to reach that conclusion as a general proposition of law, in this case, the life insurance provision has to be viewed in light of the other provision in which the parties agreed that their estate would be liable for outstanding obligations. Thank you.
You're done with your opening statement?
I am, Your Honor.
Well, as to the first issue, place to one side the notion of an implied covenant. We have a marital settlement agreement that includes an obligation to maintain the life insurance policy. And the taking of a life voided that policy. How was the agreement upheld?
I didn't hear the second part.
In light of that, how was the agreement, the marital settlement agreement, upheld?
The agreement obligated the decedent to maintain life insurance policies. Though he did maintain those policies.
Up to a point where an act by the decedent voided the policy.
That's correct, Your Honor. But that's not the only provision in the settlement agreement, meaning if the appellate division and trial court held breach, suicide equals breach, therefore declaratory judgment, summary judgment entered in favor of the defendant for the death benefits of the policies, while completely ignoring the second portion of the agreement, the outstanding obligations provision, meaning the parties contemplated they may not have life insurance. One of them may not maintain the policy.
But you wouldn't get to the question of breach under your second provision if he hadn't committed suicide and the policies had paid out.
That's
they
correct.
Were in and of themselves, in a sense, a surety for performance, correct?
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
So you have to reach the first issue first, the whether it's a material breach to have committed suicide during the time period when that act voided the contract, the insurance contract.
I agree with that, Your Honor. Our position is suicide with no inquiry into the intentions or motivations. The act, I don't want to say mere act because suicide is the ultimate act, but the act of suicide standing alone under these circumstances, we do not feel is a breach.
Well, when you commit suicide, there has to be a finding that you intentionally took your own life. So we do have intent there, no?
I would agree with that, Your Honor, yes.
So are you now looking for motive beyond intent? I'm trying to understand where your argument
yes,
is.
Yes, we do believe that there's a distinction between the decedent committing suicide to frustrate the payout of the policies and thus deprive his ex-wife of the policy, the death benefit. There's
so
a
we should look to see whether
or not... How could there be any legal... competent evidence of that, people saying, well, that's what he wanted to do. There's no suicide note. There's no way to determine what motive is unless some of the witnesses are mind readers. Sufficiently legally competent evidence, how could anybody ever determine that?
Discovery.
Discovery?
Well, I'm not certain that there wasn't a suicide note, Your Honor.
So you want us to, you think there should be an inquiry whether or not he committed suicide because he was depressive or because he didn't like the state of the world where it was at? Where are you going with this?
That there is a distinction between a suicide that's intended to deprive the...
So you're saying that the only basis on which you would declare this to be void is if he committed the suicide for the specific purpose of denying the children their support? Is that you're saying the only basis for voiding it?
No, but I think that goes to the remedy that the court could provide.
But think about that. There are a couple of ways that he could have failed to maintain his insurance coverage. One is he could have failed to pay the premiums. And if you were here saying he didn't pay the, talking about a case in which he did not pay the premiums, there would be no issue. It wouldn't matter whether he did that because he was out of money or he was gambling or he was whatever it may be that he lost his job, just was overcommitted.
Or simply
you would
forgot.
Not be looking to motive for why he didn't pay the premiums. Am I right?
I would agree with that.
Okay,
Your
Honor,
yes.
So if this is failure to maintain because he committed suicide and therefore made the insurance proceeds unavailable to his family, his former wife and his children, why is motive even relevant to it? There's nothing in the MSA that he must intentionally fail to maintain.
There is not, if there is an implied covenant, and I would agree that there should be in matrimonial settlement agreements to act in good faith in a certain way, to not intentionally frustrate something, even though it may not violate the express terms of an agreement. But the decedent did maintain the policies and paid the premiums on all of them, including the $300,000 that policy that paid out.
My question must not have been clear. If he failed to maintain for the second reason, for the alternative reason, and I'm not saying that happened, he did pay those premiums, but if he failed to maintain, you would not be here arguing that there had to be a finding that he deliberately failed to maintain for reasons other than necessity. You would be saying, I think, you would be agreeing that if he didn't pay the premiums, he failed to maintain. So if motive is irrelevant under that aspect of it, why is motive for the suicide even remotely relevant?
I'm not certain that I would agree that motive is always irrelevant, even in those circumstances. It's a court of equity. So perhaps there was a reason that one of the premium payments didn't get paid in a timely fashion, and the policy lapsed. And so I do think the circumstances, the appellant does believe the circumstances of the suicide in this case is relevant as to whether there's a breach.
And how would you argue that the policy had been maintained under the example you just gave?
In the example where due to some other circumstance, policy lapsed?
Yeah.
I wouldn't argue that it was maintained. What I would be saying in a court of equity, if there was a good faith reason that the circumstance occurred, he mailed the check out and the mail delivery didn't get there in a timely fashion, and the insurance company said, well, your policy lapsed, you need to pay X to reinstate it. I think it would be relevant to a court of equity to the circumstances of the breach.
Wouldn't we have to look under your analysis to the circumstances why he didn't mail the check timely? Perhaps he intended to frustrate the policy and he waited with this envelope sitting on his kitchen table. Perhaps he had a flat and had a call. And wouldn't we, under every scenario that I can think of, regardless, under your analysis, we would have to look to the circumstances why the check was sent in late, why policy, there was a reason why the policy lapsed, why he didn't pay the additional premium. Is it that you're suggesting it's only in cases such as this, but your analysis carries well beyond that to every instance?
I do think in a family court case, in a family law case, in the Chancery Division, that those circumstances are relevant, Your Honor.
So the court of equity piece really looks to the benefit of the children. I mean, you have a standard breach of contract. Now what you're trying to do is bail out your side because a family court is a court of equity. But here, the primary concern typically of the court of equity is the children. The insurance policy was supposed to be maintained for the support of the children, for their education, for their medical expenses. So I'm trying to figure out, why should the court of equity not enforce the contract according to the contract's terms?
We're suggesting that the court does enforce the contractual terms, the outstanding obligation language.
Well, that's issue number two.
Yeah.
That's issue number two. But even if we're talking to issue number two, I mean, where are you going with this? Because even if we agree with you that the insurance is surety and that only the outstanding obligations are what matters, there's only approximately $450,000 in the estate, and you have three unemancipated children with unknown health costs, unknown tuition, unknown all other types of things, which could very easily and probably would exceed $450,000.
It may, Your Honor, but looking at the contract as a singular document, if the court rules that the decedent failed to maintain the policy because he committed suicide, he didn't breach the entire agreement because there's a provision that deals with that specific potentiality. We don't yet know whether he breached the agreement because we know what child support is. However, we also know after one child is emancipated, the agreement says child support would be recalculated. We don't know if all of the children are going to attend college. We do know that the agreement says that the court would apply the Newberg versus Arrigo factors.
What relief are you seeking with regard to the second question?
We're seeking a remand. We're asking the court to apply the outstanding obligations language as Justice Albin just went through each of those considerations. It may very well be that the estate is insolvent and can't meet all of those expenses. It may also be that all three children choose not to go to college. They all become emancipated. But it's a quantifiable amount. It's something that we will know in time, as opposed to, in essence, ignoring the outstanding obligation language and saying breach equals death benefit of policies.
Well, your argument then is assuming that the outstanding obligations were a day for dollar kind of analysis that can be done based on the language of the obligation of support to the children. But we don't, to some extent, the trial court already did that and concluded that the 250, 250, 250 amounts for the three children was a proper reflection and estimate of what would be, at that point, an unknowable amount owed to the children over, I think it's about 12 years at the time the contract was entered into.
There really was limited evidence about what these expenses would be, including potentially college for the oldest child, who I believe was 18 at the time this case was going on at the trial court.
But it's not just college. It's extracurricular activities. It's medical expenses. It's a lot of other support that was not reduced to a set dollar amount.
I agree with that, Your Honor. They were also, my understanding is under these circumstances, the children would also be receiving his Social Security death benefit, which could defray those costs.
How much is the Social Security death benefit?
I didn't hear you.
How much is the Social Security death benefit?
I do not know. It was not in the record.
I think it's $3,500. I don't think it's going to pay for...
Not a large amount.
It's substantially more than child support was, $3,500. Child support was approximately $1,500 a month.
He was also in arrears for many years on child support, so you got to throw that onto the pile.
Your Honor,
well.
That's not accurate.
No? Okay, go ahead. Correct us.
He was not... Well, they were married... Excuse me, they were divorced... A year and a half before his suicide, there was a dispute in the record below as to whether at the time of his death he was in arrears or not. There's no evidence that he was in arrears. There was an allegation that he was in arrears. The trial court did not make a finding that he was in arrears at this time.
Mr. Nunn, have the assets of the estate been dispersed?
They have been dispersed, Your Honor.
So you're asking for a hearing and possibly recalling the money from the children at this point?
Yes, and Your Honor, the oldest child withdrew, I believe it was $149,000 upon attaining the age of 18. I'm not sure how that meets the public policy considerations of ensuring that that money is available to pay for ongoing expenses for the child to give an 18-year-old $149,000 without any oversight in the form of a trust.
Can you explain to us, even if you're correct in principle, that this should have been calculated out, why would it make sense in this case?
Because that's what the parties agreed to. Unless the trial court makes a finding after hearing testimony that the phrase outstanding obligations means death benefit. And I'll submit to you that not even Christina Wojtos believes that in her pleadings, PA 181 through 183, she refers to obligations as alimony and child support and acknowledges that the life insurance was as security for certain obligations. Opposing counsel on August 19, 2016, during oral argument, page 46 of the transcript, said, outstanding obligations equals child support and future child support. Those are numbers that can be discerned.
How?
How can
you determine now? I mean, are you asking to be put in trust and paid out as the demands accrue and that the court retained jurisdiction for the next 10 years? How do you decide which kids are going to college, how long alimony is going to have to be paid? How in the world do you make that? And isn't that what the trial court said? Based upon everything we know, it's likely to exceed the amount in the estate. It's likely to approximate what the value of the insurance was. And that's how they came to their conclusion?
I don't know, based on $1,500 a month, which would, if there were no reductions and no children became emancipated, meaning that the amount stayed the same through 12 years, it would be approximately $165,000. It's the total amount of child support that would ever be paid.
It's not just child support.
I understand.
You have to deal with the very language that you're calling our attention to, which says, in the event either party fails to maintain life insurance, ... the estate shall be liable for any outstanding obligations owed under this agreement. It's everything in the agreement.
I agree with that. I'm not disputing that, Your Honor. And I apologize if my presentation leads the court to believe that I'm saying college contribution and those things are off the table. That's not what I'm suggesting. What I'm suggesting is this is what the parties agreed to. They agreed to that language. They very easily could have said if either party fails to maintain life insurance, their estate shall be liable for the face amount of the life insurance. That's not what they agreed to. And so the $3,500 per month death benefit, the $1,500 of child support.
Your argument is we should get a hearing so that we can calculate this, even though it may well exceed the amount of the estate.
It may in this case, Your Honor. I recognize that. My client recognizes that.
Understood. But is there anything else you'd like to
I have present? No further comments.
So the last thing, you know that a remand is merely going to generate considerable legal fees that are going to tap in and just reduce the estate. Do you think that's a wise use of the money of the estate? When you're even conceding, it seems probable that the 450 is going to wind up going to the children.
Your Honor, I don't say this to be glib to the court. I'm not going to make that type of estimation for my client, whether she believes that it's an appropriate use of resources or in lay terms throwing good money after bad. I'm not even sure that we would be involved in the case at that point. I'm just asking the court to enforce the entirety of the agreement, including the outstanding obligation language.
Thank you. Ms. Annacombe.
May it please the court. Today we ask that this court affirm the appellate division and trial court holdings as the record demonstrates that 1. The decedent breached his marital settlement agreement and dual judgment of divorce, and 2. Because of this breach, the children and Christina Wojtas were deprived of $750,000 and $100,000 of life insurance, respectively. A finding to the contrary would create negative policy implications that would weaken the enforceability of highly negotiated marital settlement agreements, permit individuals to evade court-ordered support obligations, and undermine the legislative intent of New Jersey Statute 2A:34-25. So first, on February 14, 2013, the decedent and Christina Wojtas entered into a valid and enforceable contract. In this case, that's the marital settlement agreement. Both parties wrote in the marital settlement agreement that they, quote, accept this agreement as fair, just, and reasonable to the respective best interests. In doing so, in the marital settlement agreement, the decedent agreed to pay monthly child support in addition to an exhaustive list of other expenses that Your Honors identified earlier. The marital settlement agreement required the decedent to maintain $750,000 of life insurance for the benefit of his 3 children. The MSA expressly provided that in the event he failed to do so, that his estate shall be liable for any outstanding obligation. The life insurance obligations were just one such obligation under the marital settlement agreement. Now, the decedent, he breached the marital settlement agreement when he committed suicide. The policies were nullified and the premiums were returned. Whereas the parties contemplated insurance benefits would be paid if the decedent passed away, in this case, they were not paid. The children received nothing except for a few $100, about $400 per child, from the return of the premium. The decedent's actions therefore created a breach of Section 14 of the Marital Settlement Agreement because he failed to maintain the requisite coverage. Now, as to the issue of intent, a point that petitioner brings up, that intent is somehow necessary to find a breach of contract, we would disagree. Intent is not necessary to find a breach of contract. In fact, this court in Flanagan against Munson decided breach of contract does not require any nefarious conduct. A simple mistake is sufficient to constitute a breach. The appellate division and trial courts both correctly held that judgment was properly entered against the estate for $750,000, the amount selected by the parties only a year and a half after the marital settlement agreement was executed to cover their obligations to the children. The parties agreed to this amount. They specified to this amount. That is the amount of the outstanding obligation. That's what would have been paid had the policies been correctly maintained. Now, the children did not receive $750,000 of benefits, as I already stated. But the trial court and the appellate division also did not have $750,000 to provide, unfortunately, to the children. At the time of the decedent's death, there was only about $570,000 worth of assets in the estate. And taken off the top of those assets were an administrative commission and petitioner's attorney fees, as well as administration expenses, including funeral expenses. So that was about $126,000 less that the children received. So instead of $750,000, the trial court appellate division only had $447,000 to award the children. That's less than $250,000 worth of life insurance that the children never saw. Now, if we reduce the amount proposed by petitioner and send this case back for a remand to determine these outstanding obligations, it would rewrite the terms of the marital settlement agreement, because the parties selected $750,000 as the appropriate amount that should be paid to the children in the event the policies are not maintained. The agreement reads, the party's estate shall be liable for any outstanding obligation. To decide otherwise would undermine the reliability and enforceability of the marital settlement agreement and the provisions that the parties decided amongst themselves. Now, this case is also in line with other cases that New Jersey courts have decided. So, for example, in Flanagan against Munson, there, the beneficiary of the policy under a dual judgment of divorce and marital settlement agreement did not receive the policy benefits because the policy benefits were paid to another. In that case, there was a breach of the marital settlement agreement, and the lump sum of the insurance proceeds were paid to the proper and appropriate beneficiary. In Weiss against the State of Robinson, there was a misrepresentation on a life insurance agreement, and insurance benefits were not paid to the beneficiary under marital settlement agreement and dual judgment of divorce. In that case, the lump sum policy, the benefits were the outstanding obligation, and that's what was awarded to the child.
May I interrupt your presentation for a question?
Of course.
Do you believe that this appellate division decision would stand for in the future the proposition that whenever someone, in this case, frustrates receipt of life insurance policy, say through suicide, that always the face value of the policy would be the amount of damages that would have to be taken from the estate? Let me ask you, in the alternative, Konzek, which also dealt with some portion of an alimony amount that was owed to a wife, did not result in a full face value of a policy of $15,000 being paid to the wife, but only the amount that was calculated and known that was still outstanding was paid to her. How do you reconcile this decision with that one?
Sure. So in the Konzek case, there was short-term alimony for about 5 years. $200 was to be paid per month, and then $100 at a certain point in time. So there was only, it was a calculable amount that was able to be decided and determined. So in that case, there was only, like you said, Your Honor, $2,000 remaining.
Mm-hmm.
No benefits were unfortunately paid to that beneficiary, which is why she petitioned the court for the full $15,000 policy. And in that case, it certainly would have been a windfall. There's no dispute about that because there was only $2,000 remaining for the alimony obligation.
So my question to you is, does mm-hmm. the appellate division decision in this instance render that type of analysis unreachable in the future?
I want to make sure I understand your question. But the way that I would reconcile Konzek with this case is alimony is a little different. So certainly we have a claim for alimony in this case, which is Christina Wojtas's claim. But putting that aside and just focusing on the children for a moment, Your Honor said earlier that there's incalculable amounts because the MSA here is so broad. It includes tuition, uniforms, registration, lab fees, and the amount is not as calculable as it was in Konzek.
So your answer is if it was calculable, it would be required to be done?
I would say it would depend in that scenario on whether or not there was a definitive windfall.
You've argued in this case that the obligation is the face value of the life insurance policy, the $750,000.
Yes.
We should be guided by the language of the agreement itself, correct?
Yes.
You're focusing on the second half of the handwritten clause. It seems to me, and I hope you'll correct me if you see it differently,
sure,
that the agreement says, number one, maintain a life insurance policy.
I agree.
Number two, if you fail, then you're liable for the outstanding obligations. So that handwritten language seems to suggest we're beyond the life insurance. If it's not been maintained, then here's what we do. Why are you reading it? How is it that you're reading it differently? Explain.
Sure. So in this case, it's not just outstanding obligations. And I noted that in petitioner's paper, they kept quoting outstanding obligations. But it's any outstanding obligations. And it's owed under the marital settlement agreement.
What do you mean by any outstanding obligation?
I beg your
what do you mean by any outstanding obligation?
Well,
because the agreement only speaks about child support and doesn't go any outstanding obligation. It's not that broad.
Well, the marital settlement agreement in the handwritten note, it reads that the estate shall be liable for any outstanding obligations. And I think that we'd have to agree that under the marital settlement agreement, one of the obligations that the decedent had was to make sure that $750,000
of life. Isn't that a circular argument? Because the sentence says, if you don't have the life insurance, then we look to what the outstanding obligations are. It sounds like you're ignoring that first part of the agreement.
Well, it's because I haven't seen a case where, so
let's take this case.
Sure.
Look at the language here that the parties agreed to.
In the event either party fails to maintain the life insurance under Section 14, such party's estate shall be liable for any outstanding obligations. And it's our contention that the life insurance provision is one such obligation.
So think about that, because overlaying this determination of whether there's a breach, we're also talking about priority under our inheritance statutes. So I'm going to give you a hypothetical. Assume that the remaining support obligations are calculable. And say they're $250,000. That's all. But the life insurance is $750,000. Are you saying that the children get $750,000 when they only have support of $250,000 and all the other creditors of the estate have to take a walk? Are you following my example? Go ahead.
I am. I think that this case is slightly different because
go with my hypothetical.
Okay. So taking your hypothetical, if the amount of support was calculable.
$250,000.
And that's what was to be provided to the children.
Are you saying they get $750,000 and the other creditors get nothing?
Unfortunately, those facts aren't here, but if they were here, I would still argue that the parties decided on $750,000 as the amount of
but now
value
policy. So we're now court of equity,
mm-hmm.
and we're dealing with the inheritance priority provisions. How do the children get ahead of the other creditors on getting monies that aren't completely unrelated to support, and they're jumping over them?
Well, I want to address the priority issue, certainly, but I do just want to address one facet that Your Honor mentioned just a moment ago, and that's that the husband shall obtain a life insurance policy naming the children with a face value of $750,000 for the benefit of his three children. Now, the policy reads that upon emancipation, the face value may be reduced by the husband by $250,000. So he has the obligation upon emancipation to have reduced it. He could have chose not to, but certainly in this case, no child was emancipated at the time the decedent passed away, and no child is emancipated to date. In addition, Your Honor, if there was to be a calculable amount of $250,000 and that $750,000 of life insurance was simply an inappropriate number, then the decedent, while living, was free to make an application to the court to adjust and modify that type of support. And certainly in this case, it was contemplated. It was contemplated in the alimony provision because in the life insurance provision that was to secure the alimony payment for so long as...
Are you suggesting there's a duty as events develop to make applications to the court to change the property settlement or marital settlement agreement that the parties entered into as events change?
I'm sorry?
As events change, are you suggesting there's a duty to change to apply to the court to modify the marital settlement agreement?
Yes, Your Honor. If there's
unless there's a Lepus argument, is that appropriate? Would a court grant that unless there's a changed circumstances Lepus argument?
Well, I think that in order to make that type of application, it should be done while the decedent is living by the decedent.
But he only survived this MSA by less than 2 years. What had changed that would cause him to go into court and look for an adjustment in that very short time before he unfortunately and tragically died.
Nothing, Your Honor.
Nothing had changed. So what, this is really totally hypothetical about what he could have done in terms of going back to court, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. In fact, the day before the decedent passed away, there was an order that I'm aware of that we mentioned in our appellate briefing about the decedent, making an application to change his alimony and support obligations, but not the life insurance provision, and the family court denied that application.
A day before he committed suicide?
I believe so, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. But this comes back to, again, the alimony provision here. So in the alimony provision, it reads that every year that the decedent is maintaining his alimony obligations and on time, that he can reduce his life insurance obligation by $30,000 each year. So clearly the parties contemplated that as the agreement goes on, there could be reduced needs and as well as reduced security necessary. Here the parties could have decided in the life insurance provision for the children to reduce it upon the birthday of each child as the agreement went on, to address Justice Albin's point, that it's possible to have structured the selected amounts in this case to have reflected a diminished need over time, if that's what the party has anticipated.
Your argument, though, is in response to Justice Albin's question, reveals that what you're trying to do is to make the insurer's obligation to pay $750 the obligation of the decedent to pay into his estate or have his estate pay out to the children and others who are creditors of the estate. And I think you're conflating two separate agreements.
Okay.
His agreement in this language that was added at the bottom of page where paragraph 14 appears talks about outstanding obligations under this agreement. And other than the duty to provide for an insurance contract that remains in effect, there was no other obligation to provide $750,000 out of some other asset that the decedent have. Was there?
Just the obligation to maintain the insurance for the $750,000. Now, I think it's appropriate, too, to also talk a little bit about the parties coming to this decision to maintain $750,000 of life insurance. I mean, the premiums on such a policy are relatively, can be paid, they can be maintained. And in this type of a case, by having certain events, such as medical, dental, prescription drugs, psychotherapy, psychiatric therapy, extracurricular activities, cell phone expenses, undergraduate costs, vocational school costs. I mean, the lists are certainly expansive in the record on PA 47.
Has any other case around the country, and I know you've cited quite a few, mm-hmm. Given the broad interpretation that you're asking this court to give to breach of the insurance contract?
Yes, Your Honor, there are, and there are many in our jurisdiction. So, for example, in In Re State against Boyle, the court determined that terminating a life insurance agreement, he just terminated his policies, that was a breach of a marital settlement agreement, and the full value of that policy was awarded to the proper beneficiary under the marital settlement agreement and judgment of divorce. Weiss against the State of Robinson, there was a misrepresentation on a life insurance application, so the insurer did not pay benefits to the beneficiary. In that case, there was a breach, and the full lump sum was paid to the appropriate beneficiary, and by that I mean the individual named in the marital settlement agreement and the judgment of divorce. In Mackling against the State of Mackling, there was a partial payment, so the life insurance only was $50,000, and the decedent had an obligation to maintain $100,000. In that case, the full $50,000 was accounted to, and the estate was liable for that remaining amount to reach the full $100,000 amount.
Do we know in those cases whether or not the expense, the obligations of the decedent exceeded or matched the amounts of the life insurance benefits?
That type of analysis was not conducted, and that's
See,
why
it could be a very different kind of it could be a very different scenario if, in fact, those appellate courts and were proceeding on the basis of a trial record that established what you are arguing occurs here, which is that when you add up the total cost of three children's education and other expenses, the remaining assets of the estate are going to be depleted here, and it's going to probably exceed that amount. How do we know that those cases stand for the proposition that in a situation such as Justice Albin's hypothetical where there is a much smaller ultimate obligation than the full value of the policies would be provided?
I think that that would depend on the case. I think that it would depend on whether or not, you know, certain factual nuances. Yesterday I was going through many of these cases, and it appeared to me I was trying to see when the marital settlement agreement was entered into, and then when the decedent passed away to determine, well, maybe that's a factor in why these lump sum awards were amounted, and it didn't seem to be
The nature of these cases are likely, if the policies have this two-year provision, they're likely to be cases that arose when the decedent had not gone very far into their obligations, right? Because
correct.
Just by definition, they're going to be within 2 years of the MSA,
yes,
or two
sir.
Years of the insurance policy having been bought. So are there cases out there in which the insurance proceeds were granted in the entirety to the claimants, notwithstanding a finding that the actual obligations were quantifiable and were much smaller than that amount? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you're not aware of any of the case that says that?
The only case I'm aware of is Konzik against Konzik, which dealt with the alimony provision where there was only $2,000 remaining in that obligation.
Right.
But
right.
That's
and that's really an unusual circumstance. That was a very small alimony obligation to
correct,
begin with.
Sir.
Ms. Annacone, if we don't accept the argument that the face value of a life insurance policy is the obligation, but we find a breach, should this go back for a hearing? Tell us your position.
No, Your Honor. Unfortunately, there's vast policy implications. First and foremost, marital settlement agreements. If a provision reads any outstanding obligation, and in line with these other cases I cited to Your Honor, such as In Re Estate against Boyle, Weiss against Estate of Robinson, Mockling against Estate Mockling, Flanagan against Munson, Konzik against Konzik, Della Terza against Estate of Della Terza, Prudential Insurance Company against Prashker, Prudential Insurance Company against Reiter. In those cases, the lump sums were awarded. Now,
so please, here's my question. If we don't accept the argument that you're advancing,
yes,
should this go back for a hearing to determine what the outstanding amounts are?
Respectfully, no, Your Honor, because it would undermine the certainties that the parties had when they selected the $750,000.
Asking a different question. Let's assume you do not prevail.
Yes.
Is there something specific about this case that warrants a hearing or would raise a caution flag that it's unnecessary?
I believe it would be unnecessary. I'm not sure the type of discovery that would even be necessary other than to we'd have to wait.
Wouldn't it be a very easy hearing from your perspective based on your representations as to what the children's costs are? If, in fact, any of the children have gone, and I don't know the answer to this, have any of the children gone to college?
Yes.
So wouldn't you be able to very easily quantify the expenses that have been incurred that the decedent would have been responsible for between the date of his death and today, and add up that number?
Certainly. But it's my understanding that petitioner would like to leave the estate open or create some type of vehicle such as a trust where payments are then distributed and then any remainder would potentially be left over for other creditors.
But you're essentially telling us there's not going to be any remainder.
That's our belief, yes, Your Honor.
Why would that be, if there is a remainder, why would that be unfair?
If there is a
we don't know because we don't have, there's no discovery, but
correct.
If that was a fact, why would that be unfair to create a trust, protect the monies, and if not, no longer needed by the children, to satisfy the other creditors?
Well, for two reasons. First, the party selected on $750,000 as security, and because that amount was in the marital settlement agreement.
If that's right, then there's no need for a hearing because you're saying you're entitled to the full amount no matter what their actual circumstances or expenses are.
And
so there would be no point for a hearing. It would be moot under your analysis.
Correct.
But if you assume there's a hearing and that you're wrong in that, why would it be unfair to create a trust and then provide money and if anybody's left over, pay? And I recognize the statute says that child support is a priority. However, once child support is satisfied, why would it be unfair to not protect the funds, the assets?
Because the parties didn't structure their marital settlement agreement in this way.
Let's assume you're wrong. Let's assume we decide that that's not how we're going to do it. We're going to send it back for a hearing. Okay? What's your argument?
The reality is that there's not going to be much left over.
Okay, and are you going to be able to establish that at the hearing?
Yes, Your Honor, but
And you can do that with reasonable certainty, I assume.
Yes, Your Honor, but I will say, in addition to the amount of money that we're talking about here, which is certainly not the $750,000, this is and has been difficult. I mean, we're talking about a marital settlement agreement, support obligations for children and for a former spouse. I mean, these children and this wife are living this every day. And
of course, this is a very difficult situation for everybody. But
there's another wife. It's difficult not just for the children. It's difficult for everyone.
Of course.
So the fact that it's difficult doesn't mean we shouldn't do equity or shouldn't do the right thing.
Well, in terms of doing equity, Your Honor, if the parties intended that there should have been some type of hearing and for any remainder to possibly go back into the estate, then the parties could have structured their marital settlement agreement like they did in Jacobiti against Jacobiti, which is a Supreme Court case.
How old is your youngest child now?
I believe 17, Your Honor.
17.
Still in high school.
Because I'm trying to figure out at what age that child would be emancipated and how long you'd have to keep the estate open and all the uncertainties of health and the course of education, the various other things.
Sure.
If he doesn't go ahead.
And the other piece is, are the attorney's fees coming out of the estate? Like, who's paying, if this goes back down, who's paying the attorney's fees?
I think that's a really good question, Your Honor, because certainly there's, I mean, the petitioner has already received over $126,000, portion of which I believe around $80,000 to $90,000 or so was used to pay her attorney's fees at the trial court level. But so if this is remanded, I would anticipate that the petitioner would make a fee.
At the youngest child, 17, absent going to college, it would end next year, would it not? 18 is the age of emancipation for child support. So we're talking about a year.
Well,
doesn't the contract take it to age 23 if the child goes to a higher education?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. And
what are the ages of the other two children?
I believe 19 and 20.
So 23 is the outer age if they all go to college.
Correct, Your Honor. Okay. And that's specified in the marital settlement agreement. Mm-hmm. And just to get back to the Jacobiti against Jacobiti case, in that case, the parties specifically contemplated in their marital settlement agreement that there would be a trust and that anything left over would be paid to somebody else. Here, the parties could have structured their marital settlement agreement, and if that was the intent of the parties, then a trust could have been established for remaining amounts to go to other creditors, other individuals.
Do you understand that, you know, your papers make an argument that just the realities of the situation indicate that this amount is going to exceed the estate assets. That's your argument, just practical reality of the situation. But the fact is we do not have a finding, and it's an unfortunate situation, but we do not yet have a finding of what those amounts are. How can we decide this case if we don't accept your essentially amount of the policy wins the day no matter what the actual circumstances are without that finding by the trial court?
If Your Honors did not accept the lump sum amount, and if Your Honors were inclined to determine that the $447 that the children received divided three ways for each child, and Your Honors decided to remand them, then that's what would be necessary for that type of a hearing.
The 19 and the 20-year-old, are they both in college now?
Yes, Your Honor.
Have the monies been distributed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Have the monies been used in part?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, there was an emergent application that petitioner filed once the trial court distributed the funds to the children.
So do we know how much of the monies have already been used?
I do not, Your Honor. I can't.
Okay, but they're paying, are the older two children in college?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Okay. Are those monies being used for their tuition and other costs related to their education?
Yes. And as Your Honors noted, I mean, the extent of the obligations under the marital settlement agreement here were extensive. I would just like to point out one thing that the petitioner mentioned earlier regarding the eldest child's withdrawal of those funds. There was an emergent application to the appellate division to stay monetary distribution of the funds to the children. And in that application, the eldest child, in this case, Taylor Wojtas, submitted a certification that the surrogate of Morris County required her to personally withdraw the funds because she was of 18 at that point, and it was just a procedural reason. That's why she had to withdraw the funds. But as soon as she had the check, she gave it to her mom to hold for her under the terms of the MSA. So it was just a procedural reason she withdrew that money.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that there's reasons here why, certainly in terms of equity, one of the greatest maxims of a chancery court is the court should do what ought to be done. And in this case, the $750,000 policy was not paid. Awarding the full amount of the policy is appropriate. In this case, we also urge Your Honors to look at the cases such as De La Terza against the estate of De La Terza, Prudential Insurance Company against Brashker, and a Prudential Insurance Company against Reichter. In those cases, if there's a judgment of divorce and a marital settlement agreement, by virtue of that judgment of divorce, any insurance proceeds that would have gone to another individual, such as this case petitioner who has a claim for $500,000 of insurance benefits, those, if that money was paid, it would be equitably assigned right back to the children and to Christina Wojtas because of virtue of the judgment of divorce.
Thank you.
In this case, we urge Your Honors
to I just have one last question. The 447, was that split up three ways or four ways?
Three ways, Your Honor.
Okay.
The 447 three ways, which was $302,000 less than the $750,000.
Thank you.
So we pray that Your Honors affirm the decision. Thank you.
Mr. Nunn, rebuttal.
Justice Albin, you asked a question about counsel fees. I just want the record to reflect that. The only reason that $550,000 is in the estate is because the appellant pursued the Greenwood defendants and obtained a settlement for $550,000. So, yes, her attorneys were paid part of their fees, but part of that was to pursue $550,000 against the Greenwood defendants, who are now out of the case.
But the point of my question was, if this is remanded, whether or not the continuing legal costs will come out of the estate. Can you answer that?
That would be up to the trial court judge to decide. He or she would have some discretion.
Okay. Is it fair to say that if you generate fees, you're going to request the estate to pay it?
If I were to represent the appellant at the trial court,
yes,
I would make that application.
Okay.
So that takes us back to the heart of the question as to whether a remand makes sense in this situation where you have two children in college with the obligations of college tuition and room and board and $149,000 distributed to each of the children.
With an agreement that requires the children to apply for all loans, scholarship grants, and financial aid before either party's contributions to college are required. So again, I'm just asking the court to enforce the entirety of the agreement. And I also wanted to note Boyle and Weiss are unpublished appellate division decisions. McQuigley is a trial court decision. Jacobiti did not involve an agreement and involved a trial court who imposed a trust under NJSA 2A3425, and this court decided whether that was equitable and appropriate, and this court said it was appropriate under those circumstances.
Tell us why it would be equitable in this situation.
Why it would be equitable to create a trust, which
so
is what was
proceed,
done.
To proceed with another hearing in light of the numbers.
Because we continue to talk about incalculable amounts. They're not incalculable. They're in an agreement. If Mr. Wojtas was still alive, they would have discussions about what 65% of the dentist bill was. Those are proofs that are discernible.
Not in 3 years. You're going to know what the medical costs are in 3 years? You have one child is, what, 17 years old?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so he may not reach his majority until age 23. Do you know what the state of his health in 3 years is going to be?
I do not, Your Honor. I'm not suggesting that the administration of this is going to be an easy thing to do, candidly. I'm not. But what I'm suggesting is this court has provided for this kind of relief in Kiken versus Kiken, a 1997 case, 149 NJ 441. The agreement in that case had very similar language to the life insurance provision in this case. This court remanded to the trial court for a hearing to replace the defendant, decedent, with the estate to determine the appropriate contributions to college from the decedent's estate. So there is precedent for this.
Is it equitable for the court to send this back for some general hearing where there could be arguments made and potentially in perpetuity, or to send it back for a limited hearing for a quantification of the question whether the obligations as they have transpired since his death add up to more than the assets of the estate, and if they do, game over. Now, I understand you prefer the open-ended hearing.
I don't know that I prefer that.
No, I'm sure. Well, I get that. I get that. And I know you're obviously you're arguing on behalf of your client. But an open-ended hearing is one thing that may make a whole lot less sense than a very streamlined hearing to find out for sure: are we at the point where this is where we are simply talking about assets that don't exist?
I do agree. It could reach that point. I don't know if the children are.
The hearing would add to those points, because once the attorney's fees and costs are taken out, there'll be, it sounds like a Pyrrhic victory to me, either side. Once the money goes to the attorneys and then the state is depleted, it's no win for either party.
I don't think there really are any winners in this, Your Honor, and I say that with all sincerity. My point is, these things that we're talking about as amorphous figures, they are all calculable. If Mr. Wojtas were alive, they would be having these discussions about this cost this. This bill is this, you owe me 65%. I'm not suggesting the administration of it is something that should happen in every case, but that's what these two people agreed to when Mr. Wojtas was still alive.
Mr. Nunn, I respect that answer, but in addition, didn't the parties have some conversation that as each child reached the age of majority, the insurance obligation for the child support amount would be reduced by $250,000? So can an argument be made here when you're looking for rough equity that the parties have agreed that 250 is the amount for those difficult to calculate, difficult to estimate expenses that look forward into the future? That's the amount per child that would have been appropriate to support as the MSA contemplated.
Could a trial court sitting in the Chancery part reach that conclusion? Yes, Your Honor, but as a matter of contract, for many of the reasons, and I believe it was Your Honor that asked my adversary the question about are there any cases that stand for the proposition that the face amount of the policy is what should be given in equity, I don't think as a matter of law the court should say that the parties intended that the fair amount per child was 250. The trial court might reach that conclusion. But I still do not see, as I read the parties' agreement and I looked at the pleadings, how that outstanding obligations equates to 250 per child or 750.
So you don't see that as a liquidated damage estimate that should be enforced unless it's shown to be unreasonable. And the burden of showing that it's unreasonable would, of course, be on you.
It could be, Your Honor. And I'm not trying to tap dance in front of the court. It could be. But one of the considerations that has to be taken into account, and the Chancery Court would have to do this under the case law of the state, the Social Security payments that the children receive would be considered against the child support obligation. And if the court's correct and the death benefit's $3,500, that's substantially more than the decedent's child support obligation. So I'm not suggesting you should get a dollar-for-dollar offset. But what I'm suggesting is I think that some caution and prudence and a circumspect approach to what the expenses are. County College is different than Princeton University. These are all things that can be discerned.
What's the relevant point in time? When we look at damages for the contract, don't we look at the time that the contract's entered into? You have us looking at a future point in time and adding in a lot of information that the parties didn't have when they signed this agreement.
No, but, Your Honor, they did anticipate ongoing child support until emancipation, ongoing contribution to extracurricular activities, an analysis of the party's ability to pay towards college after loans and grants. So those are all things that are forward-thinking possibilities of the parties. Mm-hmm. And, again, as I stand here, Your Honors, I understand the administration aspect of this. I truly do. And I would have a difficult time arguing my position in the case if the handwritten provision was not in the agreement about outstanding obligations, because I do think the Chief Justice is right. It's sort of circular to interpret outstanding obligations as the death benefit.
We myself included, have not given you uninterrupted time for the few rebuttal points you want to make. Is there anything else you wanted to add? We're well beyond the 3 minutes now.
I addressed the points, so thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you to both parties. We'll take the matter under advisement.
Anyone need a break before the next?